we had some of the tunnels in the city that were flooded up to like 3 meters height water, which means that there were actually cars floating. Fortunately, there are no losses of life, but there are huge financial impacts. These small devices, these sensors, are both able to sense this, to measure these variables, and to communicate.
Welcome to the Problematic Podcast, a show that gives you the chance to be the hero in helping solve some of the world's largest problems. Find out which teams need your skills today at problematic.app. And now, here's your host, Sean Tierney.
All right, hey everybody, welcome to the Problematic Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Tierney, and I am here today with Tiago Marques. Tiago is co-founder of Green Metrics, an Internet of Things platform that makes smart sensors and data analytics to mitigate the risk of climate action failure. Tiago is a graduate of the Instituto Superior Técnico with a master's degree in mechanical engineering and a specialization in energy. He has over 5 years of experience in management consulting, focusing on the implementation of improvement solutions, integrating finance, strategy, operations management, and customer experience within various international organizations. Welcome, Tiago.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
Great. Okay, so let's start with the problem here. What is it you guys are helping solve with your technology?
Yeah, so we're trying to use IoT and data science and its full potential to help mitigate the risks of climate change, which is, I think, one of the most important and most urgent topics or issues in this era. And the context for this solution is that even if we are doing efforts to try to work on the causes that are changing the way that climate affects us, so CO2 emissions reduction and other mitigations for the causes of these problems, we saw that this is an opportunity to also mitigate the effects, which means in parallel with the actions that are being taken to mitigate the causes, we need to start working on the effects ASAP. And this is becoming more urgent year after year, and I think we've been noticing in whether you're from Europe or whether you're from the US, that the wildfires that are happening in California, in Europe, in Turkey, the floods that are happening in Germany, in Portugal in December, just last year, we're moving from extreme to extreme. Mm-hmm. And this is creating huge social and economic impacts. And so this is what we're focusing on. So we're basically using these smart sensors and a software platform to visualize this data and to process it. And the idea is to be able to take action both reactively when the catastrophes are happening in a quick way. Mm-hmm. But more than that, even is to be able to become proactive. So acting before the catastrophes actually happen and helping businesses, cities and individuals to protect themselves and to be able to take measures before they are affected to the full extent of the damage.
Got it. So attacking root causes of the things that are, you know, these catastrophes or whatever that's bad that's coming out that's causing climate change. So going after the root causes while simultaneously recognizing that we're already too late on some things and that now we need to start mitigating the outcomes
here. Precisely.
Okay. Well, can you unpack just like Internet of Things? Don't assume that anyone knows what that is. Mm-hmm. Can you just explain what is Internet of Things?
Yeah, sure. So the Internet of Things is a buzzword that is called to basically describe the capacity of small electronic devices to be connected to the internet and to each other. Mm-hmm. So that's why you call it Internet of Things. So it's based on electronic components, so small sensors that are taking some type of measurement, whether it's location, whether there it's temperature, humidity, the presence of an object. So these small devices, these sensors, are both able to sense this to measure these variables and to communicate these results to the internet and to each other. Okay. So if I explain in 1 minute, that's the Internet of Things. And what it enables is that you are suddenly or gradually able to use this type of devices to gain a new understanding and to collect data from the environment that you couldn't before. So it allows, so different devices allow you to collect metrics in different areas of in different segments, from environments of nature, of industrial processing, municipalities. So basically it allows you to collect all of this data and create a database of nature and of the environment digitally.
And these are not just capturing, but transmitting in real time, because you guys use the Helium, the LoRaWAN network.
Correct.
So not only are you able to log massive amounts of data, and it's data, we're talking what, like visual data, any data, thermal?
Yeah, depends on the sensing unit. Mostly when we're using LoRaWAN, we're talking about small packets of data. So more like temperature, humidity, CO2 concentrations, detection of gases, detection of intrusion, distance of objects. So basically using the LoRaWAN network, what you are able to do, and this is a bit the main value proposition of LoRa versus other technologies like 4G or Wi-Fi that everyone knows. So maybe just to introduce quickly what LoRaWAN is a low power, long distance communications protocol. So it allows sensors or devices in general, but in this case applied to sensors, it allows these sensors to send small packets of data with a high frequency through distances up to 10 kilometers from a gateway. So basically what it means is that you don't need to have infrastructure spread around where you're going to use these sensors, because if there is a gateway in a distance around you of up to 10 kilometers, 10 kilometers in rural areas, in urban areas, something lower, more like 2 kilometers. Mm-hmm. But what it allows you is to just use these devices without being concerned about how close you are to an antenna. And also, since they are such low power devices, they also have long battery lifetimes. And this allows you to have these devices located in areas where you maybe have a difficult access, or maybe you don't want to be doing maintenance frequently. So they have batteries that last up to 5 or 10 years, depending on the reporting interval. And this becomes economically viable to install a large number of devices in locations that are not necessarily accessible, like mountains or rural areas or farms. So with LoRa, you are able to communicate this data in over long distances and while having sensors that you don't have to maintain, and they will just live there for 5 to 10 years without any interaction.
Okay, I think that's a good summary of the tech. So let's go back to the problem and try to kind of unravel climate change. If that's kind of sitting at the pinnacle and we say that is the massive gnarly like problem we're trying to unravel, what in your guys' estimation are the contributing factors, or the ones at least that you think we can affect?
Yeah, so usually what I like to, like, it's a famous quote, which is what you don't measure, you don't manage. And climate change wise, I'll give you the example of one of the verticals that we are working on, which is smart irrigation and water usage optimization. We've been seeing in the last 2 to 3 years, at least in Portugal, but it extends to Europe and certainly to other continents. We've been seeing reductions in agricultural yields of 15 to 20%. So the problem is that the changes in the climate profiles in the regions are actually having a concrete effect in the capacity of production of agriculture, vineyards, and whatever other products are being farmed. So
I saw on the slides that one of the slides was something like Portugal is 96% extreme drought.
Yeah, right, last year. That's crazy. Last year was an extreme year. And I've heard recently that the forecast is that this summer will be again very dry. So last year was an extreme year where 97% of the Portuguese territory was in what is considered by the authorities extreme drought.
Yeah.
So this has a significant impact, because when you are farming food products, if you start to have 20% reductions, 30% reductions, that will have an effect on pricing. So I'm even before saying that there will be scarcity, this will affect prices, because if you have less water to try to produce as much as you can, and there will be yield reductions, then you have higher prices. So that's the first impact.
Right.
And just to connect that to the technology and to the devices that we are using with a concrete example. So today, the way that certain agricultural crops are farmed, they use what is called calendar-based irrigation, which is, of course, there is an empirical knowledge and there is an experience of years, but this experience of years ends up becoming a bit obsolete when the climate changes completely, right? So right. Even if you have people who are experienced in dealing
how
with
it used
30
to be,
years, 40
screwed
years,
up, yeah.
Exactly. So nowadays, everything is changing, so the knowledge that they have from the past doesn't necessarily apply.
Right.
So to connect that with the use case that we are applying, we are using soil moisture and temperature sensors that are put underground in the agricultural fields, in this case, in vineyards. And what these sensors allow you to do in a very practical way, if you follow me, is that they are measuring in real time what's the percentage of humidity in the soil. And the farmer or the manager of the operation is able to see in real time how moist is the soil, how humid is the soil, right?
Mm-hmm.
And up to now, the way things are done are calendar based, which means, okay, I will program my automated irrigation system to water every night at 9 p.m. once or every other day, and I will manage the water like that. But if you are using this standard system, you are probably watering the soil when it's not needed.
Right.
So you are using the underground reserves of water for no gain, for no added benefit.
Right.
And what the sensors allow you to do in the first stage is to understand when the soil needs to be watered, when the plants need to be watered concretely. So it will show you that the soil is now with 85% humidity. So maybe you decide not to use water that night and you only prioritize using the let's say artificial irrigation, which is not the natural rain irrigation, when it goes below, let's say, 50%. And in this way, instead of being watering millions and millions of square meters on a daily basis, maybe you will save 30% or depends, but 20, 40% if you are watering only when the plants need it.
Right.
So on the first stage, it's about gaining knowledge. So these metrics are giving you the ability to know the behavior of the soil when in the middle of these changes, right? So
right.
When you're having the most extreme weather events in the last 50 years in terms of drought, and then in the next season you have the heaviest rains in the last 50 years that are flooding the cities, you need to have these metrics, right? Because otherwise you're based on old school, let's say, quote unquote, old school knowledge that is not necessarily applicable anymore. So
I think, so the mental model that I'm having here is like, I walked home the other night and it was, you know, a rainstorm and their sprinklers are going in the park. And I'm just looking at it thinking like, what dummy is running the sprinklers right
exactly.
now? It's such a waste of water. So this is essentially that on a bigger scale.
Yeah,
right?
Multiply that by many, 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 many hectares of plantation. And you will imagine that the water that is in underground is not infinite, it's finite.
Yeah.
Last year, this is also an important data point related to the drought situation in Portugal. So last year, in the summer, in August, it was it was like a report from the weather agency saying that there is a map with a color coding of the regions, and you could see that all over Portugal, maybe like 80% of Portugal, the underground water reserves were below the 20% level.
Okay.
So that gives you an idea of the urgency of the problem, right? So if you're watering without being smart about how you're using those resources, you're maybe 2 or 3 years away before you run out of water underground, right?
Right.
If this trend continues.
Right.
So that's what makes it urgent to adopt such technologies. And what I think is also a high value proposition is that due to the nature of the technology of LoRa and the devices that we are using, it's quite cost effective. So it's not a multi-million euro installation to have the benefit. It's something that is pretty accessible. It's not only for big corporations. It's something that works for small and medium size farmers as well. And yeah,
well, and also this isn't just altruism. This is like straight profit for the farmers, right? Like this is maximizing the efficiency of your water usage. Exactly. So it's exactly. Dollars and cents.
Exactly. But. And it's funny because we've been thinking of it more in the water usage reduction, mm-hmm. but it's something when you start to get into the agronomics and farming technical side, you start to understand that you don't want to only reduce the water usage, because in some cases there are yield losses because the soil gets too moist. So there are fungus infections and there are diseases that spread because the roots start to rot when it's too moist.
Right.
So one of the reasons for being too moist is that you are watering randomly.
Right.
So if you're putting water on top of the soil that is already saturated, right. you're creating a swamp.
Right.
And this swamp also reduces yield. So that's why we call it water usage optimization, which is not necessarily reducing it to the minimum, which in the summer that's the case.
Right.
But even in non-drought situations, you also want to keep the water level in the soil in an optimal range so that you escape these diseases that exist from, let's call it, dumb watering, right?
Yeah, got it. Okay, so this is one of four, like the ones in your deck here: water usage optimization, flood detection, wildfire detection, and wildlife tracking.
Yeah.
Are those the four, this is on the proactive side, the four areas that you're attempting to fix?
So the philosophy behind these four verticals, let's say, is that we found out, I mean, while we are developing the concept of the company and of this business, there is a huge toolkit, right? So there is a huge toolkit of different sensors, all based in the same communications technology. So the framework of communication and of processing the data is all the same, but we had to narrow it down a bit to a bit more concrete use cases. So we are focusing on these four use cases. And I think this is actually good food for thought. So we already thought about this far, and we know how to execute them, and we know the benefits behind them.
Mm-hmm.
But we challenge the idea generation for other use cases that you could apply this type of sensors and technologies to that we might not have thought of. So this is just a start. But for now, we are starting with irrigation optimization, as I just explained now. With flood detection, so we finished now in the first quarter the implementation of a pilot, basically an innovative project with the municipality of Lisbon.
Mm-hmm.
So we have installed 10 flood detection sensors in some of the highest risk areas in the city that in December last year were completely flooded. So if you've been here,
I was here. It was right before Christmas.
And exactly. So yeah, in some of the tunnels of the city, it was a convergence of factors. So it was concentrated in 4 hours. It rained the same as in December last year. Yeah. So the whole month of December, which is one of the most humid and rainy months of the year, the whole volume of water fell in 4 hours. So imagine it was like a massive tropical rain concentrated in a short period of time at the same time as it was high tide, which means that the underground drainage system was not flooded, but you see what I mean? Like it was high tide, so that the tide goes into the piping system, so the water has nowhere to flow.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so there's no water flow through gravity because the piping is packed with river water or ocean water.
Yeah.
So in December, during one week was the worst, but it happened a couple of weeks in December. We had some of the tunnels in the city that were flooded up to like 3 meters height water, which means that there were actually cars floating who thought they didn't know the depth of the tunnel.
Yeah.
So they thought, well, there's water in the tunnel, but they just started going until the car starts floating.
cars became boats in the, in the tunnel.
Yeah, so I mean, we're laughing, but if it's just one car, yeah, it's a funny situation. But the damages to, you know, to the infrastructure, and fortunately there are no losses of life, but there are huge financial impacts. And because of that, that's why we approached the city of Lisbon with this solution, and they found it interesting. So we discussed what would be the best way to implement a pilot to, you know, prove the technology working. So we did that in the first quarter, and we just finalized. And the idea of this pilot is, on one hand, to be able to in the first moment, to detect the flood as soon as it's happening. So we have these sensors that detect liquids with a dipole. So when the water touches the sensor, it closes the circuit and it sends an alert message to a dashboard that is with the civil protection department. So they will get an immediate trigger saying that there is a flood in this tunnel. Send a unit at least close to investigate. To investigate if it's needed to close it, or if, you know, take some preventive measures in the first moment. And so this is the first goal of the pilot project. But then there's a second goal, which is a bit more medium term, which is to monitor the drainage system, so the rainwater drainage system. So we also installed some water flow level sensors that allow you to see in real time what's the level of water going in the underground pipes,
throughput
that are upstream from these high risk areas. So the idea here is, you need some data to be able to make something out of it. So I'm saying, maybe in a year, when we have enough occurrences, we will be able to predict the occurrence of a flood downstream based on the flow upstream. Mm-hmm. Right. So
can that alter your behavior though, as a municipality? Like, do you divert water in different places, or that allows you to make decisions, or is this purely like an early warning to say, hey, that we're about to have a really big problem?
At this point, it's, so from the practical point of view, this one is to start to establish a correlation before the flood actually happens. But what was discussed with the municipality and with the authorities was that this should be applied in the rest of the drainage system, because it will also allow you to identify blockage points, identify areas that are under dimensioned for the water flow that should pass, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So besides this preventive role, it also has what I was just saying just before, if you don't measure it, you don't manage it, the idea is to also be able to have these real-time metrics and this historical information about how the water flows through the underground pipes, and identify if you need to make an improvement in a certain section, or if you're having blockage points because sand gets deposited, and when you start with a section of 2 meters, after a few years that the sediments get deposited in that area, suddenly you have like a bottleneck.
Right.
And you start to get effects of that bottleneck upstream. You start to get floodings in the street because the water is trying to flow, but it can't because it's blocked by deposits of sediments. So all of this data today is not collected in any way. It's more empirically, the authorities know that from time to time this usually happens every 2 years or whatever, and they have to make a preventive maintenance, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and it's anecdotal. It's kind of just like the crops, right? It's like this kind of tribal knowledge that's gained over
time. Yeah, and it's usually too late. It happens after, or
it's when something breaks. Something breaks.
The maintenance happens after something bad. After something is broken.
Yeah.
And the idea here is to prevent that. So you are able to see the water flow patterns, and with the same principle of the soil moisture sensors, these water flow sensors are showing you, are measuring the distance to the surface of the water, and they're sending it over the LoRaWAN protocol to the gateways that then connect to the server. And so the authorities and the water management entity is able to understand what's happening, whether or not there is a catastrophe, and also to take proactive actions to improve the system so that it avoids catastrophes in the future.
So how, if you don't mind me asking, if we're in a tunnel, and there's a sensor. How is that able to communicate this LoRaWAN? Does it pierce the ground somehow, or how does that work?
Yeah, so the LoRaWAN protocol communicates over a frequency which is 868 megahertz. So this frequency is a low frequency that is able to pass through concrete. Metal is a bit harder, but through concrete and buildings it will pass. It will deteriorate the signal, but it will not block it. It will still pass. But what we do basically is we adapt the cables of the sensors in a way that the sensing unit is on the lowest point of the tunnel and the transmitter is in the highest point of the tunnel, which maximizes your chance of connectivity, right? So
got it. So it's an antenna extended.
It's basically like a small dipole, like a small like size of your thumb device on the side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
That is not exactly on the bottom, otherwise it will be triggered with false positives. So it's maybe like 5 centimeters above, which means that it will only be triggered if the water comes from below and up to 5 centimeters. And then it's connected with a cable to the transmitter unit, which is usually like 5 meters or if possible outside the tunnel, just to avoid that it's, you know, having to fight against the concrete.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Okay, so I think I got it. And I think a really important point that you alluded to is that you guys are essentially a platform company that then chose these four specific use cases to focus on for now, but really you, I mean, this could just as easily be carbon monoxide detection in the tunnel or
smart
whatever.
Parking or yeah
whatever, yeah, pedestrian, like how many people walk a certain path every day to see if
for
you
sure.
so really, yeah, you guys are just like a data analytics reporting real-time capture type of company.
The way I usually call it in an affectionate way is that we use these sensors as little data printers. So they are just printing data from the environment, and then whatever we do with that data is where the value is, right? The sensors are just helping you to quantify some metric, whether it's soil moisture, the presence of water, or the height of the water in the drainage system. We are just trying to capture reality digitally.
Right.
And then in this platform, we build the platform and customize it to the user's needs. That's where the analytics are done. That's where you're going to take the historical data and you're going to correlate the upstream water level with the downstream flood detection sensor. And you're going to, when you have enough occurrences and you have a statistically significant sample, you are able to say that once the water level reaches 75% of the section upstream, you have 95%.
Right.
Confidence interval that downstream there will be a flood within 27 minutes.
Right. You know?
So that's the goal.
and you guys are both capturing all that data, but then processing it and making those recommendations, or the customer in this case might be the city of Lisbon, and they come to you and they say, hey, we have this problem. We want to have early detection of floods. So you look at the situation, you deploy your sensors, you have the data analytics platform that is then analyzing that and sending the alerts and doing all that. You can process
all of that. But also, just out of curiosity, maybe it's interesting, Lisbon has, I don't know if you should call it a program. Yeah, a program of open data. So there are several sensors and devices and devices to measure stuff spread around the city. And there is this open data program, which is basically a platform, public platform for citizens to access. And you are able to actually download and process that data for any data science projects you have or for any studies that you want to make. So in this case, we are processing this data, but we are also sharing the data with the city of Lisbon so that it's open to the public and that other
groups like ours
and data scientists and people who are knowledgeable with data or want to learn with data and want to do their own projects with real data to also use something that is not theoretical but it's concrete and reality based,
you know? Okay, well, so we'll get to the solution layer here in a second. I guess I want to still talk about the other use cases. So we discussed water usage optimization, that was flood detection. Talk to me about wildfire detection. What do you guys do there?
Yeah, so again, I tend to start repeating myself, but I think you got the point of the the advantages of the LoRaWAN communication protocol and how it works, right? So in the wildfire detection vertical, basically what we have are carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide sensors. And these are, in the same way, autonomous wireless sensors that can communicate through distances of up to 20 kilometers. And the idea is to put them in high risk areas for wildfires, whether it's close to camping sites or to picnic by the road sides, or, you know, there are plans to even spread it over the forests, but then you start to get to a problem of, okay, how many
diminishing
sensors
returns.
How many sensors do you need to get the benefit of a few minutes or a few or an hour of early warning? Because that's what we're aiming for. Because typically in a wildfire, I'm not an expert in wildfires particularly, but what we know is that in the first 20 minutes of the wildfire, you are able to either kill it and it will not be even a wildfire, it will be just a small fire if you act within the first 20 minutes.
Right.
If you let it go more than 20 minutes up to 1 hour, it's a very high risk that it becomes a huge scale wildfire, depending on how the locations are clean and how much fuel is in the forest. So what we're trying to, the goal with this solution is to gain those 20 minutes or to gain that early warning system so that you don't need to have a huge column of smoke that is, you can see it from 10 kilometers away and you see, oh, there's a wildfire, send the authorities, because this is usually happening
by
in remote
that point,
locations.
It's too late.
By that time, it's already like the scale of the damage is much, much higher. So with these sensors, you can spread them in these high-risk locations. And the sensor, the same way that the flood detection sensor will trigger a warning when the water touches the sensing unit and closes the circuit. In this case, you can monitor in real time the concentration of these gases in the atmosphere. So you can define parameters of trigger that when CO2 or carbon monoxide is detected above a certain, you know, baseline average, then it triggers a warning, and that warning might be enough for a fireman unit to just arrive and check what's happening.
Right.
And if they see that the fire is starting, they kill it immediately.
Right, right. Okay, so in practical terms, I'm just imagining this here. So you've got a countryside and you've got kind of like a net of these things spread out in the strategic areas where you want to canvas and know, mm-hmm. like, hey, this is really important that we catch it early, mm-hmm. because there's like a residential neighborhood nearby or something.
Exactly.
So you put kind of this mesh network of these sensors, and then when it, like you said, detects certain parts per million in the atmosphere, it says, okay, the like this is above the normal. Like this
exactly.
isn't a camper having a campfire. There's something bigger going
exactly.
on.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Gotcha. All right.
That's
the principle. Okay. Got it. All right. So that's wildfire detection. What about wildlife tracking? What's that all about?
So wildlife tracking, it was actually an inbound request that we received about a year ago. And it started developing into a more concrete project that we will start to implement now in the next month. So basically it's using LoRaWAN location sensors, which is pretty much similar in functionalities to a GPS sensor, but with a much longer battery lifetime and depending on where it's located, with a better connectivity. And the proximity to the gateways is also important. So this wildlife tracking solution is basically using these small devices that have the same characteristics as the previous one we've mentioned, but these ones can be even smaller. And in this use case that we are starting now, we're going to deploy 15 GPS trackers with the National Agency for Animal Conservation, where they have a protection program for the Iberian lynx. You know, lynx, these wildcats. And
I'm looking at it here on your slide. Yeah,
exactly.
<That's cute.
laughs> So they already have a protection program, and they've been using GSM and VHF technology sensors, which is quite old school, and it has very limited functionalities. It shows you basically that an animal. So today, what these biologists have to track the life patterns of these lynx are these GSM and VHF sensors that tell you basically that yesterday at 4 p.m. the links passed by this area, and right. that's the data point that you have. And with these LoRa sensors, what you're able to do is, I usually say this as a joke, but it's what it looks like, you're like playing Sims, because the links is moving, and you can track it every, depends on how you set up the sensor, you can track it every 2 minutes, you see where it is located, you see its patterns, you see its changes in behavior, with relating also to the climate profile changes. You can see if it's changing the area where it feeds, you can see if it's moving up north for colder weather, or if it's getting less mobile because it's too hot to move. So all these behavioral changes are important from a biological point of view. And the idea of this vertical is to be able to use this quite, let's say, cost-effective solution to put it in these animals with a very low intrusive, like the sensors that they have today are quite heavy, bulky, and with a big battery. Yeah. And these ones are very small. They're smaller than your car keys. So it's like your car keys that are on a collar on right. on the neck. And it provides data like temperature, humidity, location. In order to conserve battery, they sleep while the animal is not moving. And then when the animal starts moving, they start reporting again. Okay. So that gives them lifetimes of up to 2 years without having to interfere with the animal.
Right.
Which is quite
Because it wouldn't be practical otherwise. No, exactly. You're constantly having to catch
exactly. You're talking about wild animals. You don't want to disrupt their life patterns, at least the minimum possible. So using this technology also allows you to have a very low intrusion in their lives by having to only interact with them once, and then the sensor will be transmitted for 2 years without issues.
So, but with this particular use case, I guess, what are we doing differently based on this data? We're tracking kind of the migration and the habits and how they change over time with respect to climate change and whatnot, but is it informing decisions? Are we doing something differently about it, or what's the usage of it?
I would say that there is both an academic point of view for biologists to understand the impacts of climate change, mm-hmm. right? So more from an observation point of view. And then there is another action, line of action, let's put it like that, which is more preventive and to avoid that the animals have, let's say, I don't know how to say it, but that the issues that are being caused by climate change will affect them, their reproduction, that they will be moving, for example, from more remote areas into more occupied, human-occupied areas. Then they start to get closer to roads. One of the issues that was reported to us while we were preparing this project was that in the last 4 years, they've identified that 9 lynx out of a universe of like 200 or 300 were killed by cars. They were run over by cars. So these changes in patterns are threatening the continuation of the species. So one of the features that we are implementing from a technical point of view are virtual geofencing. So it's basically a digital fence that you draw on a map. And in this case, we are drawing them around national roads, mm-hmm. which shows you that if a lynx approaches the national road within a range of whatever we define, 500 meters, 200 meters, the biologists get an alert. Whether they're going to close the road or to, you know, just let the mother lynx with the cubs pass in right. safety, I don't know how they will apply it, right. but the idea is to be able, again, to manage it in a way that allows them to reproduce and to stop this decline in the individual's population.
Right. So this one isn't necessarily like an interventional, it's more of an observational, like
yeah,
you're saying.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
Got it. And you're on the weight question, I find this fascinating. One of the animals on here is the Eurasian eagle owl.
Yeah.
So I would imagine it has to be pretty light to put it on a bird
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, yeah. So the same agency of natural conservation, once they Once they closed with us, they a few weeks after, they called me and they asked me, "Hey Tiago, can you get some lighter sensors too?" And I was thinking, lighter sensors than this, like 50 grams. So, okay, let me check. I will do some research. I will see if I can find something. And then we started. And then he explained me why he wanted lighter sensors, because they have this Lynx conservation program, but they also have hunting birds and some birds that are in threatened, how do you say, extinction threat.
Endangered species.
To also be able to track them. But in order to do so, they could not use 50 gram sensors, because there is a let's say, convention limitation for how much weight a wild animal can carry, and it's up to 3% of their weight. Mm. So for the case of birds, he would need a sensor that would weigh maximum 5 grams plus battery, so 10 grams. And I was like, okay.
Engineering challenge accepted. Yeah, exactly.
Let's see what we can find. So we did a lot of research. Oh, and there were some more technical requirements that were hard to meet, which is, if you're going to put a sensor on a bird and you will let it fly, I mean, the sensor should last a few months, right? You're not going to put the sensor on a bird, catch a wild bird,
yeah,
put a sensor that will give you just a few data points. You need it to last a bit.
Sure.
So based on that, this was the trigger for us to start also the development of what will be, it's still in the plan, it's still not developed, but what would be the lightest LoRaWAN geolocation tracker, in order to apply it on these birds, which will basically give them a location and will be ultra low power consumption, in a way that it will allow the sensor to transmit at least once a day for minimum 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So that's therefore
yet another engineering requirement.
Yeah,
here.
So, exactly, yeah. Exactly. But we are working on that. We have a partner company who is basically an R&D electronics company. They make their own devices, they develop their own sensors, and this is something that we also want to focus more on. So to also start to develop our own technology and not only apply existing technology, even if in this first stage, for us, it's what makes more sense, because you don't need to reinvent the wheel to ride a bike. You can just buy a bicycle. So right now we are buying these data printers in order to get the data, but there is still a huge opportunity to optimize on the electronics side and on the data capturing side. This is just an example of a use case or a necessity that was brought to us by the final customer, and we went out to our resources looking for a way to make it happen, and hopefully it will happen still this year. It's still under approval for the agency to get this funding and etc. But we are hoping to be able to work on that later this year.
Cool. All right. Well, so I think those are the four main use cases. We're kind of like going to transition now. I mean, we've been talking about solutions, because all of these, what you're proposing, are basically the solutions that you guys have come up with. But in terms of, for a person listening, it sounds like there's different ways to engage with what you have. So you are a platform, you are your own customer of the platform to start. Have you guys opened it up yet to the point where someone else could build on it? Or are you guys the only ones right now who can actually, you know, create an application that uses your sensors and that?
No, actually it's pretty democratized. I mean, we are developing it to our customized uses, but it's not closed to other people to develop. Actually, there are third-party platforms that you can use and just develop your own dashboards on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good starting point. If you are listening and you are interested about these topics, there are a few, that's a handful of options to create your own dashboard. Then you can start to play around with your sensors and create your use cases. That's a bit how we started too.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's not a super closed, let's say, software platform.
Proprietary lock-in.
Yeah, no, it's a pretty accessible. I mean, I'm talking about the data integration and data visualization, because then what you do with that data, that's the whole value, right?
Right. So
this is then analytics and data science methods that we will apply for predictive analytics based on this data. But the actual platform, it's something that is accessible, and I think that's one of the advantages of all of this, because it's not locked under a golden gate that you can only access if you are a powerful corporation. It's accessible for any small farmer or any city or anyone who has a bit of entrepreneurship and motivation. You'll get there.
So you don't have to share your prices, but what are we talking ballpark wise? Like, if I'm a farmer and I want to know more about like the humidity of my soil and my fields, what can I expect roughly to pay to get into that game?
Yeah, so our business model is we sell the sensors and we charge a subscription fee for the access to all this intelligence that is generated by the data. And the typical price of a LoRa sensor, it will depend on what you are measuring. So some of the sensors have a bit more complex systems that make them more pricey, but we're talking about a range of between 100 to 300 euros per unit, mm-hmm. which is quite accessible if you think from a B2B point of view. So you can achieve a high scalability solution with quite a granular data collection matrix with a few thousand euros, so it's...
Yeah, and what's the impact? Like the wildfires in Portugal last year, I would imagine the cost of that had to be...
Yeah, last massive. Year, I mean, the last, let's say, 5 years, it's been quite... I don't know the statistics by heart, but it's been quite sad, to see such huge extensions of... previously healthy forest that is, some of these forests are even centuries old. They were planted by some of the Portuguese kings in the 1400s, and huge extensions that change the landscape and make it much more rich. And since I think 2017 was one of the worst years, there was a huge extension of a burned area. There were houses that are burned down, people that lose their homes, without even talking on the wildlife animal impact, which is maybe a bit harder to measure because, you don't have a quantification of how many birds or mammals lost their habitats, but it's a very big impact. And not only in Portugal, you can see last year in Turkey, in the US,
Melbourne,
California, Australia. So it's quite scary. If you look, I'm 31 years old. If you look back to the last 5 years and you look 20 years before, it's not the same. The last 5 years are not comparable to the previous 50 years. And it gives you a bit of a sense of urgency to be involved and to try to find ways to mitigate these events, because if the trend continues like this, we are in for a rough time.
Well, so this is maybe a controversial, I'm not going to take a side, but I'm going to put forth an idea that was proposed to me by a friend who's kind of got a tinfoil hat when it comes to this stuff. But climate change, do we know, my understanding is that it goes through cycles over generations and that we're in yet another uptick of this cycle. Is there any chance that this is not caused by all the carbon emissions and whatnot that man has done, but this is a natural uptick? Or does it matter? I mean, if the fact that it's going up, whether it's man-made or nature-made, we need to do something about it?
I was going to go a bit more on that direction, which is if you think about what we're doing, whether it's man-made or it's a cycle of the planet, it's having a concrete effect, a negative effect on crops, on city infrastructure, on wildlife. So whether it's man-made, man-caused or nature cycles...
Doesn't matter.
I mean, if you can optimize your operations to be less affected by it, you will win. So that's a bit the premise that we use with whether it's man-made or a natural cycle.
And that was kind of my response to him, was like, look, if there's an asteroid heading to Earth, it's pretty clearly not man-made, but we're going to do something to try and stop that, right? So this is just a different version of that.
Exactly.
Cool. All right. Well, so in terms of how people can engage, it sounds like the opportunity here, from what I understand it, you've got the open data platform, where you guys are writing data to this platform, it sounds like. Is there a lag on that, or is that near real time, or what's the latency?
No, there is a lag. It's not us who is sharing this data. It's the municipality of Lisbon. They have a whole data team and data management program. I can tell you, I think the name is Lisboa Aberta.
Okay. Like
Open Lisbon, Lisboa Aberta. That's the name. If you Google it, you might find it.
We'll link all these links we talked about put in the show.
But yeah, it's not real time data. What I know is that they upload maybe, I don't know, if quarterly or twice a year, they upload data sets with specific metrics. And then there are some open competitions, I think, that they have some questions open, you know, like Kaggle
for machine learning. Say, yeah, exactly.
Kind of a bit simpler, more modest version
of
Kaggle, you know, they just make the data available and then you can use it for academic purposes or personal purposes. And I think there are even some challenges from time to time where there is an open question and then people are invited to come and try to answer this question.
Make a model make some sense of it. Okay, exactly. So this is more data analysis. Like, given the lag, there is no interventional opportunity with the Lisbon Open Data Project, but there are these kind of make sense of the data that it's out there type challenges.
Yeah, for sure.
And then the methods that you said, and we can link to some of these resources if you can give me the links. That the other way to go here is that, like, these systems that we're talking about, like, if someone wants to go find a sensor that's on the market, they don't have to build this from scratch. There's things that exist out there. There's the Helium network that you guys use. So there's, like, the building blocks are all there. And that this is literally limited only by your imagination to envision what might solve one of these problems.
This is actually one of our challenges in the beginning, which is to prioritize, because depending on who you are and what challenges you are dealing with, whether you're a farmer or you are a plant manager or you are a traveler, or the opportunity, or not the opportunity, but the possibilities that you have to apply this type of technology for your benefit and for the benefit of those around you is exponential, you know?
Yeah.
So every 3 years, more sensors are coming into the market. They are becoming more affordable. You have initiatives like the Helium network, which basically, I don't know if people are familiar, but Helium network is a protocol that manages LoRaWAN providers and users. So basically it's a blockchain based protocol that regulates the mechanism of incentive for people to deploy their own gateway infrastructure, which means that you basically put an antenna in your balcony or on your building, or in our case, on radio towers, and you earn rewards for deploying this infrastructure. And then on the other side of the equation are the users, who pay a very, very, very small fee, like a residual fee, for being able to send data through the network. So Helium is a, let's say, 5-year-old project. I don't want to make a mistake, but something around that. And what they enabled was that anyone who wants to use a sensor and connect it to the network, they can use already existing infrastructure for a residual cost.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you don't have to buy your own antennas and spread them around in order to be able to benefit from the technology, because someone else already did that.
Right.
And around the world, there are almost, I think it's reaching the 1 million hotspots deployed. I think it's something like 980,000 hotspots, which is huge. And in Europe particularly, most, if not all, I think all the urban capitals, the capitals of Europe and most of the big cities are fully covered, are even oversaturated, redundant, which not saturated, but it's redundant. You have coverage everywhere, which means that anyone in any of these locations, and even in remote areas, if you are within, let's say, 10 kilometers of a gateway, which in Portugal is pretty likely, you can deploy your own sensors using the Helium network and just get it used, just start to using it and start to develop your own use cases, you know? So I see it also as a democratization of access to technology, because before initiatives like Helium, you would have to make an infrastructure investment if you want to have access to this type of communications protocol and to use this technology to solve your issues. But
or like, it sounds like maybe, you know, you literally would have to put like a cell phone or have some kind of hotspot.
You don't need a SIM card. You don't need to put antennas. You just have You just need a sensor, whatever you want to measure, whether it's the soil moisture in your farm or whether it's the location of your dog when it goes for a hike or, you know. And you can use the already existing infrastructure without the need for the user to make this, you know, huge investment on setting up the coverage, because the coverage was already set up by this community. And we end up leveraging all of that too, because it becomes much more attractive from a consumer point of view that you just plug your sensor to the network and suddenly you are getting it on your laptop or on your smartphone.
Yeah.
So it makes it's a democratization of the access to this type of technology, because suddenly you don't need to invest the capex to install multi-$1,000 antennas, and you just plug it and start benefiting from it.
Yeah. And it uses, I know you're a Web3 enthusiast, so it uses this really creative tokenomics to incentivize the density that matches the usage, right? So they have this idea, like where we're recording right now, Startup Lisboa, if you look in this sector on the Helium miner network, there's 12 miners in this one little division, right? It's like this massive saturation where, of course, that it's needed the most. And it's all due to how they have it,
Yeah, and the protocol is designed to be self-optimized, which means that the incentive for the gateway deployers is higher if you deploy it in a less dense area, which means that if you are deploying these gateways in a very concentrated area where there are many other gateways, you are not really adding value to the network, because, as I said, the range of communication is 2 to 10 kilometers. So if you have 12 gateways in the same area, you're not really adding value to the network. So the network is designed in a way that it will benefit more through a higher reward to the deployers who choose to place their gateways in areas that are not covered yet or that have less density of gateways.
Right.
So it's kind of a self-balancing, in theory at least, it's a self-balancing design that will make it less profitable for deployers to put one more gateway in a very dense area and to take that gateway and create new coverage in a different area.
Right. I think of it almost like kind of this self-policing sales force where, you know, you're going to share commission with these guys if you're all bunched together. Yeah. But so it encourages you to kind of go off and colonize a new area because you're the only salesperson there at that point, and now you're getting all the leads from
exactly.
That.
It's essentially the same like concept. It's a bit like that.
Cool. All right. Well, I think this is probably a good time to wrap it up. So we've got an event coming up in Lisbon. I think you're going to stop by and help mentor at that. This is an opportunity. If you're listening to this and you happen to be in Lisbon, you could definitely come and hack on that stuff there. We'll have Tiago around and he can help advise you. Other ways to engage, I'll put the links to the show notes and we'll include those resources.
Perfect.
Anything else? Where can we send people Green Metrics? I know you guys got a new website coming soon.
Greenmetrics.ai will be our website. We're launching it very soon.
Cool. All right, Tiago, thank you so much for your time. All right, cheers.
You've been listening to the Problematic Podcast. To get involved and propose a project idea of your own, or to join in the discussion around one of the projects proposed during the show, visit problematic.app. That's problematic.app. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and leave a rating and review on your favorite platform. Until next time, be the change.